So there might be some books that you've read that after reading them you thought, I've read it, I'm done, I'll donate it to the library and I'll never read it again. But there are other books that after reading it you want to keep it on the shelf. And you know you're going to want to read it again, and you do read it again. And when you read it the next time, you see something in it that you didn't see the first time. As much as you enjoyed it the first time, there's something still further in it when you read the book years later. For me, Murshid's volumes are like that, the message volumes. I could never say, I've read them, I'm finished. I have to return to them every year. And truly, every time I open those pages, they show me something different, something new. Because those books really function as a mirror to one's own state, one's own growing experience of life. And as that experience transforms, the book throws a new light on it. Our theme today is the sacred manuscript of nature. Nature is certainly such a book. We've got to keep rereading it. But it's not enough just to keep rereading it. We have to read it with new eyes. In fact, there's always a danger, a real danger. And this is the real idolatry. The idolatry is that you don't see it anymore. You don't read it anymore. You read what you remember having read. You see what you expect to see. One isn't meeting the universe as it is. One is meeting a fossil of the universe in one's own mind. Poet Percy Bysshe Shelley said, poetry creates the universe anew after it has been annihilated in our mind by the recurrence of impressions dulled by reiteration. Poetry makes the world new, enables us to see afresh. And the real poetry is prayer. And the real prayer is poetry. Not the prayer of rote repetition, but the prayer of meeting the universe anew. Recreating the universe, you might say. The universe is created by the encounter with it. It doesn't exist independently of consciousness. The universe is the meeting, the encounter. In which we are both subject and object. And all of this brings us back to the founder of chivalry, Abul Fityan, Ibrahim alayhi salam. Because this was his special prayer. He would go out first thing in the morning, meet the day, and his prayer was, O God, this is a new creation. That's the prayer of Abraham. A new creation. Waking up to the first day, every day. Step out of bed. It's the first day. But our minds are dulled by the recurrence of impressions, reiterated endlessly, locking us in a loop. That stands between vision and the universe itself. The light that fills this room, just look, streaming through the trees, streaming through the windows, reflecting off all of the surfaces and plunging into the optic nerve, lighting up the brain, lighting up the knowing mind, this stream of light. Daylight. Since morning until evening, one sheet, it seems, one sheet of light. But it isn't. Is wave after wave after wave. Sunlight pouring out from the center of the solar system. A wave comes, washes through us. Another wave comes, another wave comes. Each instant, a renewal of vision. This daylight is not this daylight. Already it changed. Every instant is totally fresh. So Ainul Quzzat Hamadani, who died for his insight into reality, he was martyred. He said, at every instant the sun stands in a new relation to the earth. And that is illustrative of the reality that at every moment, the whole universe stands in a new relation to its luminous fountainhead, the Nur al-Anwar. Every instant, new light is poured upon creation. Every instant, a new creation is poured forth. And more stories may be told of Abraham. Abraham and Sarah and Hagar traveled through the land with their flocks and camped out from place to place. They would find the oases, the wellsprings of fertility in the barren desert, and camp there, draw up the water, harvest the fruits, and then if travelers would pass by, they would invite them and welcome them. And their way was expressed in these three words: Salam, Ta'am, Kalam. Salam means peace. The first encounter with anyone, according to the way of Abraham, is to meet that encounter with peace, the spirit of peace, the affirmation of peace, the intention of peace. Before anything else takes place, the first thing is, I meet you in the divine peace. Then secondly, ta'am, meaning food. Break bread together, offer what you have to eat. The water of the oasis, the fruits of the trees. Give it. Give some part of your own sustenance and share in the sustenance. Breaking bread with strangers makes strangers companions. The word companion, one who breaks pain with you, bread. So eating together, that is to say, partaking of our common need for renewal through the great flow of nurturance that sustains this world. Meet in that need and in the answering of that need and in giving to one another in the answering of it. It seals a bond. Before all that else, and only then comes ta'am. Then only then comes kalam. Kalam meaning speech, meaning conversation. Where have you come from? Where are you going? How are you? All of these questions. So build upon companionship, build upon hospitality, and then venture toward a meeting of minds. This is the way of Abraham, it's the way of hospitality. Abraham and Sarah and Hagar learned this way by practice. And at least one story has come down of how Abraham was corrected because someone came and his instinct was to extend a hand and give something to eat. But he observed the traveler was an idolater. And he thought, I can't condone this. And so he shrunk back and was indisposed to extend hospitality. But then a revelation came. The divine voice spoke and said, this man, this idolater, idolater though he may be, I have fed him every day for the last 40 years. And you won't spare him a little bit of cake today? So the other, the one we don't welcome, the one we don't recognize, the one we're wary of, cynical of, he's of a different political party. Or she's of a different religion, or of no religion. Whatever it is, a different race, whatever it is. Well, who made that person? Who created that person? Who sustains that person and gives him or her, or whoever it is, food and drink and air and life? So that remembrance brings chivalry, that remembrance that whoever is before me, the creator is the creator of this person as completely as the creator is the creator of me. And so that was a milestone, Sheikh, a milestone on the path of awakening to chivalry in the life of Abraham. Then something else happened. He was tending his flocks. He had become very wealthy, very wealthy. He had vast flocks, many tents. And the angels started to wonder, is he, his worship, does he worship God because he does so well? Of course he's thankful, of course he's loyal, he's blessed in every way. But if he would lose what he had, would he be so thankful? Where does his loyalty really stand? Turned to God with the question. God answered, if you must, test him. So the angel came down and took the form of a shepherd who sang a verse in praise of God. And Abraham heard that song and just fell down on his knees and in tears and was weeping, was in ecstasy to hear that song. Moved him to the core. And when it was done, he rose up again and hailed the man and said, sing it again. And the man said, I will, but for a price, half of what you own. Abraham said, of course, sing it again. He sang again. Abraham was on the ground, on his knees, weeping, wailing, tearing his clothes. And the hymn finished. And Abraham said, one more time, just one more time. He was in the rapture of Sama, hearing the divine name, hearing the divine voice, and it meant everything to him. He said, one more time. And the fellow said, yes, but only for the remainder of what you own. He said, any price. He sang again, again. Abraham was in the highest ecstasy. And when it was finished, he thanked the angel with fullness of heart. Come with me. And presented him the key to all that was his, all of his flocks and all of his tents, everything. He said, this is yours. With a smile, not grudgingly, but with a smile on his face, giving it to one who he knew deserved it abundantly. Now you can imagine this angel. Just imagine what this angel was thinking. having that entertained that doubt, having brought that doubt to God, having come to earth and tested Abraham in this way, and seeing his rapture, his love of the divine name, and his fulfillment of his promise, even if it, when it meant giving up everything, he was brought to deep humility. He said, "Prophet Abraham, please listen to me. I'm not what I seem. I'm not this shepherd. It was a test. I'm come from on high. It was just to see what is in your heart. I see it. I know it. There's no doubt of it. Please. You are more than vindicated, and you must keep your flocks. You must keep your tents." Abraham just smiled. No. I promised it. I want to fulfill this promise. I want you to have it. You take it. Then Abraham went to Ishmael and Isaac. His heirs, they were the ones who, after Abraham, were due to inherit all of these flocks, all of these tents that he had now, in a moment, given all away. He looked them in the eye. He said, "I have a legacy for you. It's not these flocks. It's not these tents. It's the giving. This giving. This is what I give you. I don't give you things. I give you the giving. That's yours. That's what I want you to have from me." And he tied a sash around their waist, Ishmael and Isaac, tied a sash. And thus began a great tradition, girding, called shad, a word that conveys intensity. Wrap that sash around the waist, gird oneself up to meet the new creation, to meet the new moment in giving. Come what may, in abundance, in scarcity, always the same. Salam, ta'am, kalam. And so the way began, and it was transmitted down the eras through the prophets and their families, and through those who became, as it were, the families of the prophets, the great spiritual lineages, down through Jesus, who passed the sash on to the disciples, by whom it was received in time by Bahira, the monk, who transmitted it to Prophet Muhammad, who in turn tied the sash round the waist of Hazrat Ali. And since it has come down, the ceremony of girding in remembrance of this giving, this ancient giving. And so, in tasawwuf, in the Sufi way, there has always been the current of fatwa, legacy of Abraham. And at certain moments in history, it's been revived, given a certain form. One of the great masters of Futuwa was Sheikh Abul Hasan Qaraqani, Some of us will go in a couple of weeks to his Dargah in Kars. Come if you can. I welcome you. If you have the chance, be with us there. It's coming soon. Sheikh Abul Hasan Kharaghani said that Futuwa, Javan Mardi, is an ocean with three springs. The first spring is Sakhavat. Sakhavat means generosity, giving freely. In the way that the rain falls, it falls on the saint, it falls on the sinner. The raindrops don't discriminate. The storm clouds just give the rahmah, give the love that's in them. So to study the sacred manuscript of nature means to study the affection of the sun that just shines on all, the abundance of the falling rain that fertilizes the whole land. Be giving. Without discrimination. Salam, Taam, Kalam. And one finds that the real receiving is in giving. At the end, what you have is what you have given. What you've taken, you'll never have. What you give, that you have. And the second fountain of the ocean of chivalry is shafqat, which means compassion. You know, seeing the pain, seeing the suffering in the world around us, seeing people in difficult states, not giving up on them, not turning away, but loving them, perpetual goodwill, having no enemy, no malice, and watching, be watchful, when even the first traces, a little glint of malice starts to show itself. Be vigilant. Pause, breathe, reach out again to the other person. See with new eyes. It requires a certain fearlessness. You know, the lack of compassion, the lack of sympathy is to do with fear. One pulls back because to be magnanimous, to love, to forgive is frightening. But if one can find fearlessness, then there is no experience that one will not countenance, will not meet in intimacy. And that fearlessness comes with being in the presence of the beloved. When the beloved is near, what fear is there? Wine in my cup and the friend so near. What in the world could I possibly fear? And in that fearlessness, in that intimacy, comes acceptance, forgiveness, friendship, sympathy, shafqat. That's the second fountain. And the third is to be needless toward everyone but God, and needful toward God. Not to expect, not to grasp, not to insist on anything from anyone, but to turn one's whole expectation, to turn one's whole faith toward the one endless, all-pervading source and essence of life. Turn one's need completely toward God. And that gives one a kind of, to use Moshe's words, indifference and independence. Now, sometimes one hears those words and one thinks, that sounds cold, it sounds unkind, indifference and independence, cold-hearted. On the contrary, the most loving hearts, the most gracious hearts, the most kind hearts are the ones that are not constrained by needy expectation, by grasping possession, possessiveness, reactivity, reactivity that comes from expecting something, needing something from someone. But if instead one meets whatever is there, sees it, is with it, knows that it's not final, nothing is permanent, nothing is final, meet what is here, be with it, follow through into the next moments, meet each moment in a space of an open heart, without latching on, without grasping, without expecting, without recrimination and resentment, needing everything from God, needing not only little things from God, I want this wish fulfilled or that wish fulfilled, that's wishing small. That's meager. Don't just need a little something from God. Need everything from God. Need God from God. That's the way of Harakani. Boldness in love. Be bold. Harakani said, with the people, you know, be gentle, be courteous. With the prophet, be reverent. With God, be audacious. Be bold. Because God is bold. God loves the bold. So Harakani was bold with God. Burke was bold with God. You know Burke? Burke was an African dervish of the time of Moses. And It happened, there was a drought in the wilderness when the Israelites were traveling to find the promised home. And all the crops were withered, there was nothing to eat, there was hardly water to drink. And the Israelites kept praying, and Moses prayed for rain, but rain never came. And finally, a divine voice came to Moses and said, I want to hear Burke's prayer. So they said, who is Burke? We don't know who is Burke. But then finally, this dervish appeared. They said, who are you? He said, Burke. They said, good, we want you to pray. Go out, it hasn't rained for weeks. Go out, pray. And Moses stood beside him. The Israelites were all around. He said, I'll do it. He went out in the, out beyond the camp, looked up to God. He started speaking so boldly. Oh God, what is this? What are you doing? What is this? Is this mercy? This is what mercy looks like? He started talking like that. And Moses was taken aback, very frightened. But then what happened? The rain started falling. Started falling more and more. And then puddles were forming, and it was flooding, and there was water everywhere. And everyone started jumping and dancing. And the end of the trial had come. Everyone was celebrating. But Moses still wasn't celebrating. He really felt aggrieved. He felt that this prayer of Burke was amiss. How could one speak to God that way? And so he withdrew, and he was very somber. But then the divine voice came to Moses and said, don't worry, Moses. Burke makes us laugh 3 times a day. And there's a story of, well, Karagani was in this tradition of Burke, you know, this tradition of boldness. And so he once had a communion in prayer and meditation in which the divine voice came loudly to him and said, oh, Abul Hasan, do you want that we should show the world all of your sins so that you would be stoned? The people would stone you? Would you want it so that all of your sins would be known and you would be stoned? The divine voice said that. And Abul Hasan Karagani answered, oh, Lord, do you want that I should make it known how infinite is your mercy and compassion, so endless that if people knew about it, they would never bow down before you again? Do you want that secret revealed? And the divine voice, after a pause, answered, you keep quiet and I'll keep quiet. So many of Karagani's teachings on chivalry speak of water. Chivalry is an ocean, Karagani said, with these three springs. He says also there are 5 kinds of water. The water of this physical world, which is the water of life, he calls it. He says the Javan Mard loves it. The chivalrous youth loves that water. Water that unites all aqueous beings, plants and animals and human beings. We all drink from and share the same water. And the Javan Mard loves it. Then there's the water of the jinn sphere and the pool of Kosar. And then there's the dew of the angelic realms. There are these dimensions of water. It's really all the same water, but perceived at different levels of vision. And the Javan Mard loves it all. And then he said, and then there's the Arif that loves even a further kind of water, that is the water of love. Murshid says exactly the same thing. The same function that water fulfills with respect to bodies, revivifying, cleansing, washing, flowing through everything. Love serves that function in the inner being. But then he says there's a fifth water that God loves, and that is the water of the tears of the servants, especially the sinners, the tears of the sinners, the tears of the broken, tears of the one whose heart has been broken and who cries out that intimacy of feeling, that passionate hope and fear mingled in bewilderment, that's the purest water. A tear of the one who has sinned and whose heart has been broken and moved and looks to redemption. That tear has the purity to wash away the sins of the whole world. Now, Haragani also says that the ink of the Javan Mard, when the chivalrous youth writes, the Javan Mard doesn't write on paper. The Javan Mard writes with her lifeblood and writes on the water, not on parchment, right in the ocean. Journey through the ocean, and as you journey, write the tale of your love with your own life blood as that ink instantaneously dissolves into the vast sea, so that the one who comes after sees, here has been a lover, here has been one crazed by the divine mystery. This too is futua. May the spirit of Abraham be with us. May the spirit of Sarah be with us. Spirit of Hagar and those who came after them. All of the masters of chivalry. May Moses be with us. Peace and blessings be upon him, and Burke in his boldness. May Abul Hasan, Qaddas Allah Siruhu, be with us in the ocean through which we pass as we inscribe our life story in the ink of our blood, in the ceaselessly churning ocean. We're coming toward the end of a day of reflection, prayer, remembrance, contemplation, salam, ta'am, and kalam. One more moment now for kalam. One more chance for conversation is here. Have a few minutes. You've been reading the sacred manuscript of nature on the horizons and in yourselves. Now, the Javon Mardan are in the room. Kharagani is here and Burke is here. What is in your mind? What is in your heart? Let's speak together. Where's the microphone?
Good afternoon. I had a question about boldness. Because as you told the story of Burke, which I had never heard, I also thought of the story of Moses where he strikes the stone three times and water issues forth. And at that time, the Israelites may drink as well. And I don't know I don't quite recall, but I recall that he was chastised for this, striking the stone. And so it seems that there's an art to boldness, but that was just something that came to mind, and I wanted say and ask and think about that.
Thank you. That's a beautiful question, because it leads to really a beautiful story that I love, the story of the striking of the stone. And how, for the followers of the Sufi path, what meaning does that moment have for us? It has a lot of meaning. It belongs to the whole history of sama, listening, sacred music. And that tradition of sama actually goes back to Adam and Eve. It goes back even earlier. It goes back to that day of Alastu bi Rabbikum, we spoke of yesterday. Am I not the one to whom you belong? That was the first sama, that was the first audition, to hear the divine voice and to be in a swoon of ecstasy in the encounter with the real through sound, through voice. And since then, the thirsty ones, the desirous ones, have sought that voice. That's what Abraham was seeking when he heard the angel sing the song. It was sama, it was the divine sound, the soti sarmadi, the cosmic sound through a beautiful voice. What all of the dollar bills in this world, how could they compare to hearing, just once hearing that sound? So then Moses was in the wilderness, and there was a stone. They were looking for water. And he was guided to strike the stone with the stick. And when he struck the stone, 12 springs sprung up. And each one had a different tone. And from each one came one of the maqams of music. And he said, then the divine voice said to Moses, Musa Saqi. Musa Saqi. Musa, Moses, Saqi. That means, give them to drink. Let them drink. Give them to drink from these fountains. There were 12 tribes. The tribes of Israel were those. Each tribe had its drink. Each one had its watering place. It's mashrab. That word is used in Sufism to speak of the watering places. Already, providentially, since time before time, we have our different wellsprings, our different watering places. And there are affinities in this world that are due to drinking from these different fountains, drinking from these different streams. It's all one water. But there are different drinking places, and the affinity of those who drink in different places shows itself in a certain companionship. So there were these 12 tribes, each had its mashrab, each had its drinking place at that stone. And the command of the divine voice was, Musa Saqi, Musa Saqi, Musa Saqi, Musa Saqi, Musa Saqi, music, music. That's the origin of the word music, Musa Saqi. And so from those vibrations of those fountains came the modalities of music that then became the basis of a whole tradition of sacred music which comes down to us today and still brings us into rapture.
As I remember with that story, he was denied the ability to go into the land of Cana because he struck the stone three times because the first two times he doubted if the water would really come. Can you comment on what that is a metaphor for, what the story is talking about there?
If the prophets did not enact humanity in all of its permutations, in all of its variations, as in the story of Moses when he doubted Burke, if the prophets did not show their humanity, we couldn't derive from them that great benefit that they have for us. They have such great benefit for us because we find in them the whole spectrum of the human experience. They're humans like ourselves. They struggle. They show, they enact the struggle of faith. If that faith was just simple, intrinsic, sent down from on high, never subject to doubt or wavering, how would that connect with our life? The stories of the prophets connect because we see our own humanity in them, but we see, my father used to say, see yourself in another yourself who is more fully able to manifest you than you. So that's in the case of the prophets, they are human like ourselves, and yet having the same struggles as we do, we see their openings, their triumphs, and we see they've cleared a way for us too.
Would you please talk about the story of baby Ishmael when he struck his feet, and when Agar, mother, was going back and forth trying to find water, and then the Zamzam water came out.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that is one of the... Yeah, well, to come back to the humanness of the prophets. We see that in the family of Abraham also, that family was one that suffered tension and discord and separation and all that this entails. And in fact, the descendants of Abraham are still struggling to resolve those old fissures. One line of descent culminating in the Israelites, another one producing the Arabs, who are the descendants of Hagar, the Hagarites, all descendants of Abraham through these different lineal channels, and Christianity having emerged from the prophecy of Christ, who belonged to the Israelite lineage. And so these different prophetic families emerge from a genetic family and have diverged. There's a wonderful story in the Grail literature of the rediscovery of a Saracen and Christian knight, the discovery that they are, in fact, brothers. And that was Wolfram von Eschenbach's answer to the failure of the Crusades to vanquish the Muslims from Jerusalem, upon which they invested their entire hope for spiritual fulfillment. Now he saw that spiritual fulfillment is not found in vanquishing the other, the outcast, other who one regards as one's eternal adversary, but instead the salvation comes from rediscovering the ancient kinship, rediscovering the bond of brotherhood and sisterhood. So that work still remains to be done among the Abrahamic family. It's a great work, a necessary, vital work. And not only within the Abrahamic family, but all of the whole prophetic family of this whole world is one lineage of revelation and oneness. And there's much to be done. Our whole calling as those called to the Sufi path is to serve in this manner, the reunification of the prophetic message and the families of grace that have derived from this. But in that time, there was a tragedy that at the same time was a blessing. And that's how the whole of history goes. That in the worst moments, there's an outburst of light. And even in the great moments of glory, a shadow that is ominous of separations and conflicts to come. There's always the opposite. Separation in union, union in separation. There was a separation in which Hagar was sent forth with Ishmael into the Hejaz, into the desert, and left there, and left with little means or no means. And the desert was hot and parched, and Ishmael, the infant, needed to drink. And Hagar rushed this way and that, seven times this way, between Safa and Marwa, back and forth, desperately, desperately looking for water. And then suddenly, just Ishmael's little foot shifted the sand, and there bubbled up a spring. It would be Zamzam, the well of Zamzam. It was right there. And that story reminds us that oftentimes, in moments of great fear and worry, when we're rushing here and there, running and kicking up dust and full of agitation, right down beneath the ground, there's something there. And when she settled down, when after those paces back and forth, she could meet the child in the discovery of what was there all along, just under their feet, that renewal, that guidance, that nourishment that is there even in hardship, even in the hardest times. And so it's a tragic story of abandonment and desolation and fear, but out of that came this spring, Zamzam, that has been imbibed by billions of people across this globe from whom in whom they have found nourishment and in which they have found healing and renewal. So in the worst adversity, sometimes, by divine grace, something is disclosed which is a healing to this world. Alhamdulillah. Now we've come to the end, but conversation. Last word from Devi.
So you were speaking about Sema, and tonight is a Sema, Pirsia. And so I just want to remind people who step forward with a zikr or a poem that we are meeting at 7:15. The Sema starts at 7:30, a celebration of God's beloved joy.
Oh. Shall we say the prayer? We've said, there has been Salat also. It's time for Khatum. Yeah, Khatum. Lead the Khatum.